Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley says that on Monday, only two people have been called to testify in a special hearing about sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh and his accuser. Christine Blasey Ford went public over the weekend with an allegation that Kavanaugh assaulted her while he was drunk at a high school party more than three decades ago. Her accusation postponed his expected committee confirmation this week. One of the Democrats who's watching this unfold is former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, who joins us. Senator, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy.
How much trouble do you think the Kavanaugh nomination is in?
Well, I think it's in serious trouble. I think what we have to do is ascertain the facts as best we can. And that's going to be a process that will take several steps. Obviously, things are very uncertain at this point. We hope we can clarify them in the next few days.
How are senators going to do that? How are they going to figure out who is telling the truth, Ms. Blasey Ford or Judge Kavanaugh?
Well, that's very, very difficult. My hope is that we can avoid a circus. And the only way to do that, it seems to me, is to have an independent person, somebody who's neither a Republican or Democratic person involved with the questioning. It could be two people, I suppose. But I think if you avoid both the kind of circus atmosphere that comes with all of the politicized questions and really get to the facts, you have at least a better opportunity to ascertain what the facts really are.
Can you remember anything like this? I mean, is this like Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas?
It is. Times have changed dramatically and circumstances are different today, but in many respects, this is a sequel to the Anita Hill circumstances.
And what did you learn from that?
What you learn, first of all, is that it's important with lifetime appointments to do as much as possible to get the facts as best we can, to make a judgment. And when there's doubt, it seems to me we owe it to the courts and the country to give the benefit of the doubt to the courts and the country and not to the nominee.
From what you know so far, I mean, you're a Democrat, so you probably wouldn't vote for Judge Kavanaugh anyway, or maybe you wouldn't. But what do you think of what you've heard so far?
Well, I think we have to be – it takes a lot of courage for a woman to step forward. And under these circumstances especially, she knew she was going to be ridiculed. She knew she was going to have an enormous amount of pressure put upon her. And yet she stepped forward. I have to admire that. Obviously, we still need to know the facts, and I don't think anyone knows all of the facts at this point, but I think you have to give a good deal of benefit of the doubt to someone who does what she has done.
It's been interesting to watch how the White House has responded to this. A little more of a muted tone. The president said a little delay on this is okay. The White House is not trashing Blasey Ford at all. What do you think about that? Why is that happening?
Well, I think they realize that that there's a great deal of uncertainty around all of this. And the more it's politicized, the more the uncertainty becomes a reality that they probably can't contend with. I mean, if they have very little margin of error, all they need to have happen is one or two of their Republican colleagues who give the benefit of the doubt to the accuser, and it's over. So I think they have to play it very carefully, and that's what they're doing.
What do you think is at stake for the Republicans, especially since we're just a couple months out from the midterm elections?
Well, I think this is going to, if this nomination fails, it's going to politicize the whole Supreme Court contest even more. I fear that. I think it's really unfortunate in our country that we've put so much predictability into the process, and that hyperbolic rhetoric on both sides has done a real disservice, in my opinion, to the process itself. But this will certainly make the midterm elections even more politicized around the courts.
If this nomination fails, is there time for another before the midterms?
I don't think so. My guess is that given what few days remain, and a lame duck, I think, would be an impossible set of circumstances to consider a second nominee. This bumps into the next Congress.
The next Congress, which if the Democrats take control, they would have a little more sway. What kind of a justice do you think would be nominated if the Democrats control the Senate come January?
Well, that's a good question. My hope is that, that whether it's Democrats or Republicans, the president would see fit to nominate somebody that would be from the mainstream, that would really have the benefit of broad support on both sides of the aisle. That used to happen routinely. It no longer happens, and that's one of the sad spectacles we're facing today.
Senator, I want to ask you one more thing. Hillary Clinton just wrote a piece in The Atlantic the other day in which she said essentially that our democracy is at risk right now. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. I'm very concerned about the state of our democracy. I think it's eroding dramatically. I was troubled a lot by a question asked of millennials not long ago: is democracy necessary? And if I understand the results correctly, only about 30% said democracy was really essential today. That says all you need to know about our circumstances and how precarious our whole system of government is right now.
And how much do you think that has to do with President Trump?
Well, it has a lot to do with President Trump. He, in some ways, is the symptom, but also the cause. This has been going on for some time. It's just gotten a lot worse in the last 2 years.
That's Senator Tom Daschle, the former Senate Majority Leader, a Democrat from South Dakota. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
And by the way, Senator Daschle told us he thinks Democrats have a 40% chance of taking the Senate in November.
Recovery efforts continue today in the Carolinas post-Florence. The remnants of the storm are moving away from the southeast, but high water and flooding could persist for days. In Wilmington, North Carolina, workers are handing out food and water to people who are still in their homes because the city remains mostly cut off. Tammy Guidusi works in Wilmington. She is nursing director at Home Instead Senior Care. And Tammy, you are seeing all of this up close. What are the challenges that seniors there are facing right now?
Well, the seniors here preparing for the storm was challenging. Do they stay? Do they go? And some of it's a financial challenge for them of how they cannot get out and afford to go to a hotel. Or many of the shelters were full. Currently, we are seeing many with no power, no ability to get out to obtain water, food. The ability to get into a vehicle that's not wheelchair accessible is difficult. Many of the seniors we are from Home Instead Senior Care, we are reaching out to see what their needs are. If road conditions are passable, we are also doing home checks at this time from some of our staff that's able to do that.
And Tammy, have you done any of the home checks yourself?
I have done several of those home checks. We actually have one client. She's over 100 years old. Has no power. We did end up transporting her to the hospital due to the heat. And we are currently taking care of her little rescue dog and making sure that the animals are provided for. Seniors are very concerned about their animals, and that's another reason why they don't want to leave their homes.
Tammy, I was told that you and perhaps some of your colleagues have taken food off your own shelves at home to deliver to seniors. Is that true?
That is true. We took out of our own pantry and crackers, water, what we could cook, we did cook. We delivered it to them nice and hot. And anyone that was even in the neighborhood that we could connect with to make sure that others were nearby, because usually these communities, elderly communities, are together. So we even checked on a couple in the neighborhood also to see how they were being provided for.
What's it like when you go into one of those homes? I guess you don't know what you're going to be seeing on the other side, and I don't know if the people who are in the homes expect you, but what is it like?
Well, it's very sad. They're very scared. They're very isolated. Some of them have had medical equipment, and that's been their concern of, you know, how they're going to get their oxygen if it runs out. They have, of course, physical restrictions. They can't go to the bathroom necessarily on their own. So some of their caregivers have stayed over 72 hours with these folks just because they are so isolated and scared.
And what happens in 3 or 4 days, even for those people who are still in their homes? Do you have to keep going
back? Well, they're slowly getting the power back up and running, and we are doing daily wellness checks. A lot of times they just want to hear a voice on the other phone. These are people who have been isolated. You can't, of course, watch the news. You can't. Phone reception's very limited. Some of them just want to hear from another and discuss how they're doing.
One other question. When you spoke a few minutes ago about wishing that people had better prepared, seniors in the area for the hurricane. You sounded a little bit angry. I don't know if that's the case or not.
Well, I do feel frustrated that so many contacted us and that we're home, didn't know what to do. And when you're dealing with someone in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, it's so overwhelming and so stressful. I'm not sure they're able to put that plan in place. And as a community, we need to really work on that and come together. Seniors should be on the top of our list of who we need to be able to help first.
Sounds like you're preparing for the next time.
We are. We have learned a lot. We just need to do a better job of preparing for events like this that we understand is the risk of living in this wonderful place.
Tammy, thank you for speaking with us.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Tammy Gadusi is a registered nurse and nursing director of Home Instead Senior Care, looking after seniors in their homes in Wilmington, North Carolina, post Florence. We live in a turbulent time, and one of America's foremost presidential historians has written a new book about how past American presidents have led through difficult times. Here and Now's Robin Young has this story from Concord, Massachusetts.
We came to Concord, once home to Thoreau and Louisa May Alcott, to visit our old friend, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Oh, thank you so much for doing this.
Are you kidding? Thank you.
No.
So good to see you. How are you doing?
All right.
Probably just all right. Richard Goodwin, her husband of 42 years, father of their children, and advisor and speechwriter to both JFK and LBJ, died in May at 86. Their sprawling home on a rural road is filled with his big life.
Oh, so let me just show you these pictures. This is Dick escorting Jackie to a state dinner.
How young!
I know. Isn't this a great picture? Yeah. And then this is the best one. He's getting the pen for having the We Shall Overcome speech, which is what he worked on. And this is the pen that signed the Voting Rights Act.
And some have called that one of the greatest speeches ever written and somewhat overlooked in the pantheon just because it was Lyndon Johnson who wasn't known as a speech giver.
No, the most important thing about a speech does it mobilize people to action. And the great thing it did was by using the phrase, we shall overcome, it meant that he was connecting to the civil rights movement. And when you have the person in power and this movement coming from the outside in, then that's when you really get something.
And Martin Luther King cried when he heard it.
Yeah. It's an amazing speech. I mean, it starts out, you know, every now and then history and fate meet at a certain place at a certain time. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was in Appomattox. So it was in Selma, Alabama.
There, long-suffering men and women peacefully protested the denial of their rights as Americans. Many were brutally assaulted. One good man, a man of God, was killed.
I mean, it's incredible. This is not, and he had only that day to write the speech. I couldn't do it if my life depended on it.
Well, so, I don't know.
No, there's no way, honest to God. So, it's great stuff here.
You've written the book about four men, but there's a fifth.
No question.
Well, the other four men in Doris's life, the four presidents she's written about for years, and gathers now in her new book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, which looks at how Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Lyndon Baines Johnson handled those times. Like all of her writing, this is well-researched. We make our way through walls lined with books. We'll have pictures at herenow.org. We go through the nonfiction library to the fiction library.
How much do you love books?
I couldn't move from this house because of the books. What would I ever do with all these books? You know, it's a big part. It's our decoration, you know, instead of art or objects, books are everything.
We go through more halls lined with books. Three presidents have their own rooms.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt's upstairs. Franklin's actually here.
And finally, we sit down to talk about presidents and leadership. So the book is Leadership in Turbulent Times. By that, you mean, of course, there's a civil war for Lincoln, a Vietnam War for Johnson. But you've said you mean for these turbulent times. What's the one thing that all four of these men went through that maybe, I'm trying to think, what's the connection or the lack of connection that the current president has?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the most important qualities in a leader is the ability to be self-reflective, to acknowledge your errors, to learn from your mistakes, to grow as a leader. And all four of these men had had extraordinary experience in public life, and they were able to have humility, which means they accepted their limitations.
Well, they all had, it seems most of them had, even severe depression at certain points when they had failure.
In fact, leadership studies have shown that people who go through adversity and come out the other side stronger than they were before they went in, it gives them a foundation. Like, for example, FDR said, you know, when people said, how can you deal with all these pressures that you're under as president? And he laughed, but I think he meant it. He said, if you spend 2 years, because of his paralysis, trying to move your big toe, then somehow it's not going to seem so bad, whatever you're going through. And he learned humility. He became a different person through the polio. He had always been charming. He was always a naturally gregarious person. But having had to spend 4 years just trying to walk again, when he first got the polio, he couldn't even, his back and his chest wasn't even strong. So he would ask to be lifted from his wheelchair to crawl on the floor of his library to strengthen his back. And then he tried to tackle stairs, going up one stair at a time, crawling to the top. And the important thing is that when he got to the top, they'd have celebrations.
So a humility. But what about those who compare Donald Trump to Teddy Roosevelt, who Teddy had this, you know, bluster and boisterousness and out of my way, I'm going to, you know, ride a horse to the top of San Juan Hill. By the way, I just want to take a second on that because you paint a, I think, a more sympathetic portrait of him than I've seen, let's say, from Stephen Kinzer, who wrote the True Flag book. And he paints a Teddy Roosevelt who's kind of a foolish guy as a young man, wants to play at war, wants to ride a horse. And it's only after McKinley is assassinated and he goes from vice president to president that he achieves a maturity. Your take on him with the Rough Riders in Cuba is more admiring.
Well, I think he proved himself with the Rough Riders when he was with them to be a leader. I mean, he figured out how to mobilize them, to give them the courage and the camaraderie and the morale. So whether or not it's a good thing to want to be in a war, which I think sometimes he did, just to show his mettle. Maybe that's because he was an asthmatic kid and he used to read all these books about explorers and courageous people and he wanted to be them when he couldn't. But there always is something about Teddy. I mean, as daughter Alice said, that he so wanted to be in the center of attention that he wanted to be the baby at the baptism, the bride at the wedding, and the corpse at the funeral. So there is that likeliness to, or similarity perhaps, to President Trump.
Well, and President Trump's base has said, you know, we met so many of Trump's voters who have said that this is what they want in him. They don't care if he is crude or is bombastic. They don't even seem to care about the truth. And you write a lot about how Lincoln, you know, if it's not my word, then, you know, just it doesn't count. Has something happened where that may not matter? It used to matter a lot.
You know, if words don't matter and if the truth doesn't matter, I think then that is a worrisome thing about our democracy. I mean, in general, what I'd like to believe that these four stories show, that these men lived in far more turbulent times than ours, obviously. You have Lincoln coming in when there's going to be a civil war, 600,000 people are going to die. Teddy Roosevelt's, at the height of the Industrial Revolution, things were more shaken up than they are today. In fact, there's a similarity with, I think, what made Trump win the election, because at Teddy's time, there was a big gap between the rich and the poor that had arisen. People in the rural areas felt cut off from the big cities. Immigrants were coming in from abroad. People felt it wasn't the same America that they had known. And luckily in that case, Theodore Roosevelt understood those feelings, and he would take train trips around the country, both to the states he lost and to the states he won, so that he could mobilize a unified spirit for the country. And I think, you know, when you asked earlier about what did they have in common, I think their political experience, which was broad for most of them, taught them empathy. Lincoln may have been born with empathy, being able to understand other people's feelings and feel them. But each one of them learned that through their experiences. I mean, Teddy said when he first started off in public life that he wasn't conscious of going into politics to help other people. He just thought it would be an adventure to go into it. But then once he got into those tenements, once he was police commissioner,
he was taken to see these tenements where these workers lived in just these horrific conditions.
And when he saw that, He was against the bill originally to regulate them. He thought it was private enterprise. If you owned a house, you could do whatever you wanted in it, even if it was putting these workers in from immigrants' places and have 10 kids in the same place. But he saw it and something happened inside. And that's what you hope for people, not only in public life, but all of us, that our experiences teach us something about how other people feel and think. And then you can act on that understanding.
Lyndon Johnson saw the children in the school where he was a principal. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, this young man of privilege, brought himself to communities he never would have been able to go into. But again, Trump supporters would say he's the one who's understanding what it's like to have a relative killed by an undocumented immigrant.
Yes, he has somehow been able to make a lot of people who are in his base feel he is on their side. And because of coming into power as he did at a time when a large section of people felt that the political system was broken, and he promised that he would somehow fix it, and they believed that promise. I mean, I don't know how long that will last. You know, I don't know what happens when the promises that he made, although he does go after those promises. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to say, whether it's the wall or whatever.
Or the courts,
yeah.
I just want to close because I can't stop thinking about your husband. Did you ever talk about, you know, what he might have written for a speech for one of the four men in your book, how he would have liked to have written for them?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I mean, even in these last years, as he was working on his own book about America, it was really about his love affair with the idea of America. Mm-hmm. That's what, in a way, was his foundation. And it was all my guys' foundation. I do call them my guys mm-hmm. sometimes because I feel familiar with them, having lived with them mm-hmm. so many years. And there's a connection between all of them that they were all somehow connected to the founding ideals of the country. You know, whether that's equality or freedom or liberty, they really felt that sense.
Doris, thank you.
Thank you very much, as always.
Doris Kearns Goodwin speaking with Robin Young. Goodwin's book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, is out today. To read an excerpt, go to hereandnow.org.
Multi-billionaire Mark Benioff, the co-founder of Salesforce, has agreed to purchase Time Magazine from Meredith Corporation for $190 million. Let's get to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is executive editor of Recode. She's in New York. Kara, Benioff had talked in the past about buying Fortune Magazine or Twitter. What's his interest in media?
Well, I think it goes back a long way because he wanted to buy Twitter for Salesforce, which was he was going to try to integrate it into his services at Salesforce, which is his company. But I think he's just been one of these people who's made investments all over the place. And one of his issues are all these social issues from climate change to diversity to all kinds of things. And so he thinks that this is the best way to make an impact with the money he has.
You just spoke with him. I know the New York Times also spoke with him, and he said, mm-hmm. I live with a beginner's mind. I didn't realize 2 weeks ago I was going to buy Time. That's kind of surprising.
No, I don't think that's true. I don't think he was telling the truth there. I think he's been thinking about these things for a long time. He's been engaged with Meredith for a while. I just think he was trying to figure out which one would be the best one, and I think he decided that Time had a global brand. While Fortune is an interesting business brand, I think he thought that Time was sort of more in the areas that he was interested in, which is more social change areas.
We think of the Facebook co-founder, Chris Hughes, who spent more than $20 million trying to overhaul mm-hmm. the New Republic and ended up selling it. That did not work out well. Now, Benioff is paying a lot more money for Time. Why do you think all these people in Silicon Valley are so interested in getting into this business? Jeff Bezos, of course, being the biggest with The Washington Post.
Right. It's Jeff Bezos. It's not just Jeff Bezos. Pierre Omidyar put a lot of money into a lot of different media efforts, including The Intercept. Lorraine Jobs has bought a big stake in The Atlantic and some other publications. You know, Chris Hughes' experiment was because Chris Hughes was really meddlesome, and I think the staff rejected a lot of the changes. He was super aggressive. Most of these other people are relatively hands-off, except in the areas they're good at, which is like business and technology. And so Mark doesn't want to be involved operationally, he told me. And he certainly doesn't want to do any editorial guidance except generalize meeting with them and telling them what he thinks is important. But it doesn't mean that they have to do that.
So why does he want it so much if he doesn't want to be involved in the editorial part?
Well, because he wants these publications to continue, and he thinks they're an important part of society. And he's really rich. You know what I mean? You forget, he's a multi-billionaire. And so this amount of money, as much as it seems like a lot, is certainly not that much for him. And he thinks it's an iconic brand that should continue and become bigger than it has been in the past, even though time has had an incredible impact. It hasn't in recent years. And so he thinks he can help do that, bring back the brand. And it's a great brand. He's right about that.
Kara, one more thing. You're at the Recode Commerce Conference today in New York. What's the buzz there?
Well, a lot of the discussion here is about Amazon, of course, and the impact Amazon has on all of commerce. And so I think the overlay of Amazon on the rest of retail is really the big discussion here.
Is there anybody else who comes close to Amazon?
No, nobody. I mean, Walmart's trying. It bought Instacart and different things like that. But, I mean, all these big retailers are trying to figure out how to exist in an Amazon-dominated world. Now, Amazon would argue opposite, that they're only a smart part of retail. But I think, you know, everybody's thinking about how they can differentiate, how they can do more experiential things in stores, how they can compete in a world where Amazon has a lot of data and a lot of customer interest and an ability to, you know, do lower prices.
It's Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode, joining us from New York. Thanks, Kara.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now. At the Emmys last night, Game of Thrones won for drama, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel won for comedy, and the FX series The Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story, picked up 3 awards, including Best Limited Series. The show is about the late fashion designer Gianni Versace, who was gunned down in front of his Miami Beach home in 1997. In January, I spoke with 2 of the executive producers, Nina Jacobson and Brad Simpson. They were also the producers of 2016's The People vs. O.J. Simpson American Crime Story.
When we first got involved with Ryan Murphy, we had developed People vs. O.J. Simpson as a standalone season of television. And he transformed our one season into the first season of an ongoing anthology, which is now American Crime Story. Very early on in the process, he had said that he wanted to tell the story of Andrew Cunanan and Gianni Versace. And Brad and I at that time didn't actually know very much except for the big headlines. We just didn't know very much about the rest of the story, which was that there had been 4 victims prior to Versace, that it was the largest failed manhunt in the history of the FBI. And for me, I didn't know very much at all about actually what a trendsetter, both culturally and in terms of sort of the social politics of being out, that Versace was at the time. And so there was a lot of learning for us, but Ryan was the one who said, we've got to do it as a season.
Well, and Brad, how difficult is it to approach a story like this, which is about real people and real events, and still be sensitive to how painful and shocking the murder, not just of Versace, but the other people that Nina just mentioned, Jeffrey Trail, David Madsen, Lee Miglin, William Reese, how difficult those were.
You know, we think about the victims a lot when we're making these shows. And I think any ethical producer of something that's dealing with true crime or any true story has to always remember that there's real people at the center of it and real pain. And I can't pretend that by doing the show, we don't revisit that pain for the people out there. We think it's important to do the shows because they're about more than just the murders. They're usually about something that is bigger in American culture. And the murder of Gianni Versace really was a way for us to explore the politics of being out and being gay in the 1990s and to ask this question of why this culture of celebrity assassination exists in the United States. I think that one of the ways this show is different from The People versus O.J. Simpson is that the O.J. Simpson show we did was about the trial, and it was really about the lawyers. And this show is a lot more about the victims. It's about who these people were that Andrew killed and the sort of injustice of their deaths.
It's also, though, about Andrew Cunanan, played by Darren Criss in the show. And let's listen to a clip from the show. Here he is talking with Gianni Versace, played by Edgar Ramirez, after the opening night of the opera Capriccio, which Versace designed the costumes for in San Francisco back in 1990.
For me, family is everything. Everything. Mm. The first dress I ever made was for my sister Donatella. Maybe every dress I make is for her.
That makes me want to cry.
Makes me smile.
Yes, well, that too. Yeah, of course.
His performance is just incredible. I mean, he just lies constantly, and you can see it as a viewer.
He lies so much that I think he does not know his own truth very well. And as the show goes backwards in time to his origins, you see where those habits began. He lies so much that he eventually finds himself completely alone because nobody really knows who he is, because he's a different person with everyone.
The series is based on the book Vulgar Favors by Vanity Fair contributor Maureen Orth, and she and her publisher, Random House, stand by her reporting on this. But the Versace family and Versace's partner, Johnny Versace's partner, have criticized the series and said it doesn't reflect reality. How do you respond to that?
You know, this is not an authorized piece about the Versace family in the same way that, you know, the O.J. Simpson series wasn't authorized. We've done the same thing with this series, which is to base it on a book by an incredibly well-respected journalist. Maureen has been a senior writer at Vanity Fair for 20 years. You know, there's some things in the book the Versace family doesn't like, but it's a thoroughly researched book that's been in print for close to 20 years now. And, you know, we very much tried to do right by Gianni Versace. We think that he was a genius.
Well, one of the things that the family doesn't like is the implication in here that he had HIV. Are you confident that he was HIV positive based on what you've learned about the story?
Well, Maureen certainly says in her book, she states the fact that Gianni Versace was HIV positive at the time of his death. She talked to people who knew him. She also talked to a detective who saw the autopsy report. You know, this was a time in which HIV was still a death sentence. It was killing thousands and thousands of gay men. I think what's important for us is that Gianni Versace had been really sick and he suddenly had gotten better and it was like a miracle. And Andrew came in at this moment and took his life just as Gianni was starting to enjoy the benefits of what we believe are the retroviral drugs.
One of the things we discovered in researching this story is actually how little has been written about Versace as a man, about QAnon and the victims who came before. Maureen was one of the most, probably the most dogged reporter who was following QAnon before he had even gotten to Miami. But we also have, you know, a tragic situation where most of the people whose stories are being told are not here to tell us more. And so there is some degree of imagination that has to go into creating a story like this. And certainly for us, the stigma surrounding HIV and AIDS, the shame that was being experienced by so many gay people who were still living in the closet, the fact that the investigation was in part bungled because of the disconnect between law enforcement and the gay community, all of these sort of notions go into our imagining of what we can't know for sure and can only draw on the research that was available to us and then, say, sort of use thematic intent to shape where we go from there.
I want to listen to one more clip from the show. This is Penelope Cruz, who plays Donatella Versace, Johnny's sister, who became the brand Versace's chief designer after his murder.
As you know, my brother, who I love very much, is dead. And now the press and the police will wreck through his life. Every rumor, every indiscretion. They'll judge the killer, yes, but they'll judge the victim too. At first people weep, then they whisper.
Then they whisper, getting to the point we were talking about earlier. As you shot this, what was the most complicated thing about it?
You know, I think that the thing that was most complicated about shooting was that we were shooting in the actual house that Versace had assembled we were shooting on the steps where he died. His house was right on the street. He was incredibly accessible, and that accessibility, that love of other people, is what got Versace killed. And he created this artistic haven in this house. Edgar, Penelope, Ricky, Ryan, Nina, and I were all really taken with what it meant to be recreating a man's death in the place that it happened. And you could feel him in the house, and it had a huge effect on everybody and weighed on everybody.
Nina?
Well, I think also, you know, for us, the clip that you've just played and some of the things that Donatella says, which is that, you know, she would not let her brother be murdered twice, that she would not let his reputation be murdered. It was something that we thought about quite a bit, and that for us, this show is actually an opportunity to explore a man who, you know, is known mostly just by his brand name, but not as a human being. There was a weight, I think, for us of, you know, to not be guilty ourselves of some of the crimes that we're trying to explore.
That's Nina Jacobson, and we've been speaking also with Brad Simpson, executive producers of The Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The leaders of North and South Korea met today for their third meeting this year. They spoke about the stalled nuclear negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea. Kim Jong-un greeted the South Korean President Moon Jae-in with a warm welcome. He even met him and his wife at the airport. And then the two men rode in an open car through the North Korean capital Pyongyang, where they were cheered on by people on the streets. The crowd there was chanting the slogan, National Unification, as the motorcade passed them. Moon was smiling and waving, and Kim was clapping his hands. Jim Walsh is here and now security analyst. He's with MIT Security Studies Program and joins us in the studio. Quite a scene there, Jim.
Yes, the North Koreans know how to do a good crowd.
And have a lot of cameras there to bear witness to it. So comment on that scene. I mean, it seemed made for TV. What were the two leaders trying to accomplish before the camera and behind the cameras?
Well, I think what they're both trying to do, and in particular President Moon of South Korea, is to restart the momentum. We seem to have stalled here, at least the part that involves the U.S. and North Korea negotiating directly over the issue of denuclearization. It's not do or die, but and you don't want to put pressure on anyone, but this is an important meeting. They need to come out with some progress. President Moon is hoping by making progress on one of three different issues, or maybe all three, that they can get moving on denuclearization, that the U.S. will take steps that the North Koreans want, and that the North Koreans will take steps that the U.S. wants.
Okay, three different issues being what?
One is the elimination of or reduction in military tensions. That involves things like removing guard towers at the DMZ.
Demilitarized zone, separating north and south.
Exactly.
I mean, those guard towers seem pretty important, pretty threatening to the other side as well.
Sure, sure. And but there's that. I would say that that's important, but more important, and unfortunately, therefore, more difficult, is trying to work out a sort of a peace zone in the western part, the maritime western part of the peninsula. There's been a disputed limit there, the northern limit line, and they've been negotiating on it, but they really haven't resolved it. But so there are a set of things around reducing military tension. There are an easier set of things around sort of building inter-Korean relations. That's basically cooperative economic projects and also family reunions. The stickler there is it's hard to have cooperative economic projects at the same time that you have international sanctions. So, that's an impediment.
And U.S. sanctions in particular, this is a point of the leader of North Korea. He keeps saying U.S. sanctions are hurting us and hurting our ability to reunify, to have closer closer agreements. Is he trying to put some kind of divide between the U.S. and South Korea?
Well, certainly that has been traditional North Korean policy. It's always been traditional North Korean policy to try to drive a wedge between South Korea and its ally, the United States. I think we're in a somewhat different game here. What we're really in a situation with now is Moon is trying to hold the middle.
This is South Korea's president.
Yes, President Moon is trying. He's the one who sort of got things going. He's been sort of pushing it and nudging it along and feeding it and nurturing it. And now that it's hit a rough patch, he's trying to push it forward. He's presenting the North Koreans with sort of economic incentives and a vision of the future to sort of hold the line with them at the same time that he's talking to President Trump, who he will see this month at the UN General Assembly. And so that's a bit of a deadline. Is there enough movement here to keep all the parties on the same page and moving forward? So Moon is—he single-handedly sort of carried this process, and this will be a big test.
So he's the one who's driving it. The South is driving it.
Absolutely.
So technically, the Korean War never ended. The fighting stopped in 1953, but there was no official agreement to end the war. How does that factor into what's going on today?
It's big.
Does the U.S. want it to come to an end officially?
Well, I think in a general sense, they don't necessarily have an objection to it, but it's really a line item that the North Koreans have asked for. And in a past summit between North Korea and South Korea, the South Koreans have said, well, we'll get this done this year. Within the year, there'll be an end of war declaration.
But the U.S. has to sign it too.
Yes, right. There are four parties to the armistice, the U.S., South Korea, North Korea, and China. They all have to sign that end of war resolution or treaty. And, you know, the U.S. has balked at that. They want the North Koreans to do other things first. And so if the North Koreans are holding Moon to that, quote, end of the year deadline, you know, the clock is ticking. It's September. January is soon upon us.
So if the United States were to sign on to that, to an official end of the war, as you said, China, North Korea, South Korea also have to sign on to it, the U.S. would presumably have to remove its military presence from South Korea, correct?
No, I would not. I would not think that that's
that wouldn't be a provision.
No, I mean that's. Do the North Koreans want that? Sure. Does China want that? Absolutely.
Does South Korea want it?
I'd say South Korea has divided views about that, but I would say Moon and his progressives envision a day where there wouldn't be U.S. forces. Conservatives in South Korea, remember, it's a very divided polity. It's about half and half. They're more wary of that. But you can have an agreement in which there would still be U.S. forces. But it's all in the details in the negotiation.
So in the holdup right now in negotiations between North Korea and the United States, where do things stand? Does the North pose any less of a nuclear threat than it did before all this diplomacy started?
I mean, I think so. I think if you're not testing nuclear weapons and you're not testing ICBMs, that's a more positive, peaceful place to be in. So I think it's better, and talking is better than war. So I would say yes.
Jim Walsh, Here and Now security analyst with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.